This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to vote twice in the forthcoming November presidential election during a campaign rally Tuesday evening in North Carolina, a state important to his reelection bid. Election officials warned that the president's suggestion could cause further disruption and long lines on election day, already complicated by the coronavirus pandemic. Earlier Tuesday, Trump visited Florida, another political battleground state, where he signed a memorandum that prohibits drilling in the waters off the Atlantic and Gulf Coast off Florida and the Atlantic coast of Georgia and South Carolina for a 10-year period beginning in 2022. Trump won both Florida and North Carolina in 2016's election, but polls in the two states show him narrowly trailing former Vice President Joe Biden, who unveiled new campaign ads in states critical to the outcome of the November 3rd election. A Trump loss in either state would significantly limit his chances of winning a second term. Top Democratic and GOP leaders of the House Foreign Affairs Committee have called on President Trump to investigate the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin has denied any involvement in the poisoning and dismissed any accusations of a crime, saying there is no evidence to support a criminal investigation. But suspicion surrounding the poisoning quickly mounted against Russian government, which has used similar methods against critics of the state in the past. Most recently, the Kremlin was found to have used the same chemical weapon against an ex-Soviet spy in Britain in 2018. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Republican-led Senate will vote as soon as this week on COVID-19 relief legislation after negotiations with Democrats broke off last month, after bipartisan unity led to the approval of nearly $3 billion COVID-19 relief rescue package in the spring. The two sides had not been able to reach another agreement. The House of Representatives doesn't return to work until September 14th. The U.S. leads the world in confirmed COVID-19 deaths with nearly 190,000. The U.S. is also home to a world-leading 6.3 million coronavirus infections, nearly a quarter of the more than 27.3 million worldwide. Wildfires roared across the western state of California Tuesday, driven by high winds and unprecedented heat over the Labor Day weekend. Thousands of firefighters battling 25 blazes with more than 2.2 million acres charred since the fire season got underway early start last month. The Creek Fire in the Fresno area of Central California, which caused the weekend emergency evacuation of hundreds of people vacationing at a popular reservoir, grew overnight under what a fire official called extreme conditions. By Tuesday morning, the fire was completely uncontained and had burned 144,000 acres. Evacuation centers had been set up in the Fresno and Madera County areas as the fire moved aggressively south. India on Tuesday sent fresh supplies of firefighting chemicals to help battle a new blaze on a stricken tanker loaded with a massive cargo of crude oil off Sri Lanka's eastern coast. The New Diamond has been burning since Thursday. 19 vessels from India and Sri Lanka had battled the fire on the New Diamond, which reportedly started after boiler room explosion that killed a Filipino crew member on Thursday. The remaining 22 crew members were rescued. The tanker was on a trip from Kuwait to India when the fire broke out. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announcing he is tightening rules on social gatherings because of rising coronavirus infection rates, especially among young people. Starting next week, the legal limit on the number of people who can gather together will shrink from 30 to 6. More than 41,500 people have died of coronavirus in Britain. It's the worst death toll for the virus in Europe. The death rate has fallen to its lowest level since March, but the number of cases is increasing, with almost 3,000 daily infections reportedly recently. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian doctors strike over pay and COVID-19 working conditions.
I think that the government is so serious and residents have been patient enough, and we're giving them enough time to come up with solutions.
Boko Haram attacks leave Cameroon villagers in need of aid. Uncertainty and anxiety mount in Zimbabwe over land compensation promise. Civil society groups want Rwanda's government to reconsider some of its COVID-19 guidelines. And South Africans bristle over U.S. President Donald Trump's alleged comments on Nelson Mandela.
Donald Trump is the last person to speak about Nelson Mandela, what type of leadership, because he needs to look at the failure of his own leadership, because America is currently burning right now.
And a little Africa tour showcases Paris's hidden gems. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian doctors began a nationwide strike on Monday over unpaid COVID-19 hazard allowances and inadequate protective equipment during the pandemic. Other health workers groups and associations are threatening to join the strike. Since the country's first coronavirus case, more than 1,000 Nigerian healthcare workers have become infected with COVID-19. Timothy Obiezu has this report from Abuja.
Disinfecting his bags in his hotel room, frontline nurse Emasalome Julius has not seen his wife and months-old baby since May, when he left home to join a team of health workers responding to the coronavirus at an isolation center in Abuja. He says he did not let his family know about the nature of the job because of the fear and stigma attached to the virus. But weeks after daily contact with COVID-19 patients at the isolation center, he contracted the virus. He was treated at the center for 11 days before testing negative for COVID-19.
My case was very critical. Critical in the sense that I presented with almost all the symptoms, except that I didn't lose my sense of smell. I had fever, I had cough, I had difficulty in breathing, I had diarrhea, I had lost appetite. I could not eat for close to 2 weeks. By the time I was discharged and I checked my weight, I had shedded over close to 15 kilograms.
He continued working and received 1 month's wages, but he still debated whether he should continue the job. Then, 2 weeks ago, Julius and some of his colleagues say they did not get their wages. After demanding payment, Julius says they were dismissed from their jobs. Feeling dejected, Julius has been in quarantine without pay in this hotel room as he waits until it's safe to reunite with his family.
We feel we were used, infected and abandoned.
For weeks, healthcare employees have been demanding hazard pay and adequate protective equipment for workers on the COVID-19 front lines. Some 1,000 Nigerian health workers have contracted the virus since the first case in February. Last month, medics marched the streets of Abuja protesting unpaid allowances and undue exposure of members to the coronavirus. Administrative officer to the Abuja government, Christian Oha, responded to the protesters.
We are fighting this war with you and will not deny you of all your allowances and your benefits. Among the taxi states and Abuja, we will be paying you regularly based on our own agreed allowances.
But the National Association of Resident Doctors, NARD, says the government has been insensitive to health workers' issues. Selukowe Udwe is a regional head of the association.
I think that the government is so serious and residents have been patient enough, and we're giving them enough time to come up with solutions.
Strikes by medics are common in the West African nation, where healthcare system has been underfunded for years. But experts are concerned that the strike at this time could affect Nigeria's ability to respond effectively to the coronavirus pandemic. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Cameroon authorities and human rights groups say villagers along the Nigerian border need humanitarian aid after deadly Boko Haram attacks displaced at least 7,000 people. Villagers have been fleeing their homes since early August because of the Islamist militants' attacks, which killed at least 22 people and wounded 29. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the town of Mora in northern Cameroon.
More than 100 people displaced by recent Boko Haram attacks gathered Monday in the town of Mora to receive food aid. Several humanitarian groups, including the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, handed out goats and bags of rice, among other goods. 64-year-old Cameroonian Mahamat Judde is among some 7,000 villagers in the past months who fled the Islamist militants' attacks. Cameroon authorities say a suicide bomber hit the village of Godavi last week on the border with Nigeria, killing 7 people and wounding 14 others. Dudje was among those who fled the village, which was already hosting people displaced by the violence. He says after receiving 3 goats and a bag of rice, he is sure of having at least 1 meal a day for the next few weeks. FAO representative Fulbert Haibai Daliwa says they are doing their best to help those whose livelihoods have been disturbed by the militants.
Down said zone.
He says many of the people FAO is helping have lost everything to Boko Haram and are now very poor, hungry and thirsty. Daliwa says the FAO's goal is to help those who are suffering. The UN says Godavi has for the past 7 years hosted 18,000 displaced people who sought refuge from Boko Haram. 48-year-old Alida Waliku is a spokeswoman for female displaced in Godavi. She says the women and children have been living in hunger since last week's attack. Wakilu says the women she leads need land in safer places so they can grow maize, millet and onions to feed their families. She says that is what they long for while they wait for Boko Haram to be defeated so they can return to their villages. It was the second suspected Boko Haram attack on Cameroonian civilians who were already displaced in the past month. In August, authorities blamed Boko Haram for an attack that killed 17 people and wounded 6 others in a camp for displaced in the border village of Ngocheve. Spokesman for Cameroon's military, Cyril Atongfak, says troops have been sent to assist civilians in areas still prone to Boko Haram attacks. He says military health workers have been deployed to treat sick internally displaced people on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, where Boko Haram has destroyed hospitals and chased away health workers. Atongfak says the military gives food aid and psychological care to traumatized Boko Haram victims. The United Nations says Boko Haram attacks in the Lake Chad Basin have killed more than 300,000 people and displaced over 3 million in the past decade. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
Some civil society groups in Uganda have welcomed President Yoweri Museveni's remarks that he will penalize government officials involved in election violence. They say the president should fulfill his promise by first penalizing those responsible for the violence that took place last Friday during the ruling National Resistance Movement primaries. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi reports from Kampala.
President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni told party supporters this week in Kampala that will not tolerate any forms of election irregularities and violence, even when perpetrated by top government officials. He cited one incident in which a minister is currently detained on charges of attempted murder, assault, malicious damage to property, and threatening of violence.
We had a minister who beat people. I was seen with the guns. That one is in jail now. He's in jail, the minister. So therefore, this game is finished. I would appeal to Ugandans to be calm. Just get the facts. I have seen some of them demonstrating. The demonstration, you may cause some confusion because you may damage some property in the process. Simply write your points, we shall act.
Mwesi Warukutana, the state minister for labor, was seen in a viral video grabbing a gun from his escort and then shooting. The incident happened after he had been declared a loser in the party primary election as a member of parliament for Rushenyi County in western Uganda. At least 4 people were killed in the just concluded ruling party primaries across the country, according to the police report. Lawyer and activist Sise Kagaba says election malpractices must be punished according to Ugandan laws. But she calls it, in two quotes, laughable that the president will be able to punish those in support of his government.
I highly doubt whether any action is going to be taken. And the reason why I feel hardly any action is going to be taken, because there's a lot of impunity that is happening within the country.
However, Crispin Kaheru, an election expert in Uganda, cautiously applauded the president.
Every right-thinking Ugandan would want the chairman of the NRM party to indeed crack the whip on his errant members who are linked to the violence and corruption that happened in the party primaries. If he does not punish those involved in the electoral malpractices at the party level, Uganda is headed for a very complicated general election.
In the related development, one party member has sued President Museveni and the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM party, for failing to organize a free and a fair primary election. Julius Ntwatwa petitioned the High Court, blaming both the party and the president for the chaos in the just concluded party elections. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 9th. South Africans are angry about comments that U.S. President Donald Trump allegedly made in private about Nelson Mandela, South Africa's first black president and Nobel Peace Laureate. The alleged comments, which Trump denies, are full of profanity and include Trump saying of Mandela, quote, "He was no leader," unquote, and are part of a tell-all book by indicted former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
President Trump's alleged comments about South African icon Nelson Mandela are ruffling feathers in the Rainbow Nation, with the beloved leader's grandson sharply criticizing Trump for his leadership, and with ordinary South Africans clamoring to the defense of the leader many here simply call Tata, or father. Trump's comments, as put forward in a book by his former lawyer Michael Cohen, were reported by American media over the weekend and were strongly denied by the White House. Cohen was convicted in 2018 of a slew of charges, including campaign finance violations, tax crimes, and making false statements. White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany issued a statement over the weekend that said Cohen lacked credibility and noted he was a disgraced felon found guilty of lying to Congress. According to the book, Trump said shortly after Mandela's 2013 death that the former South African president was no leader. The other reported comments include an expletive Trump has allegedly used to describe African countries, plus slurs against black people. Mandela's grandson Ndaba spoke exclusively to VOA on Google Hangouts shortly after the comments began to spread through South African news.
Donald Trump is the last person to speak about Nelson Mandela, what type of leadership, you know, because he needs to look at the failure of his own leadership, because America is currently burning right now. You know, there have been several Black Lives Matter movements across the country where people have been rioting, people have been burning doors and you name it, and protests of the continuous killing of black people by the police cops.
The Mandela Foundation, in a statement this week, said, "We do not believe that leaders who conduct themselves in the way Mr. Trump does are in a position to offer authoritative commentary on Mandela's life and work." And the ruling African National Congress Party also issued a statement on the alleged comments, saying on Tuesday, "All freedom-loving people of the world are appalled by these insults, which come from a person who, himself, is not a model of competent leadership." Mandela received the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize for his role in ending the racist apartheid system and ushering South Africa into a peaceful new era. In South Africa, he is universally loved and ever present. Since 2012, his face has appeared on all of the nation's money. Mandela said that, to his knowledge, his grandfather did not have a relationship with Trump and did not speak of him.
When you attack us, Mandela, for me, it says that you clearly do not see or value the very same principles and values that the people that we see as progressive in this world, who are trying to create a much more united world, that you are not really much a person who has those same values. You know, we see him as a person who has actually created disparity and even division, not only in America, but, you know, influenced the cohesion of the global community.
Trump has publicly made comments about South Africa before, tweeting a week after Mandela's death that the nation was a crime-ridden mess ready to explode. VOA approached dozens of people in three locations in Johannesburg. Many did not want to speak about Trump, but those who did were invariably critical of the American president. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has not publicly responded to the alleged comments. U.S. Ambassador to South Africa Lana Marks, a Trump appointee, said in a statement that she had discussed South Africa numerous times with the president, and he has only ever spoken positively about the country. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Anxiety and confusion have gripped Zimbabwe's black farmers after the government said it would return land to some white farmers who were kicked off their land under former President Robert Mugabe. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, authorities are seeking to reassure resettled black farmers in what some fear may be a reversal of land reforms.
Heinrich von Petzold lost part of his land in 2001 in Mazoe District, about 100 kilometers north of Harare, as Zimbabwe's government adopted a sweeping land reform policy and began forcing whites off their farms. Now he may get it back under an agreement between the German and Zimbabwean governments to protect private investments in their respective countries, known as the Bilateral Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement. The German national took Zimbabwe's government to the International Center for Resettlement of Investment Disputes. The arbitration court based in Washington ordered the Zimbabwean government to pay compensation to von Petzold. He's cautiously optimistic following Zimbabwe government's announcement last week that it would give back land to some white farmers.
It's a very positive step that the government recognizes its international obligations. However, we've had many such announcements before, and we'll be looking for deeds rather than words, and we'll be interested to see what government actually does.
The Commercial Farmers Union, which represents white farmers in Zimbabwe, refused to comment on last week's announcement by the government. Back in July, Zimbabwe's government signed an agreement with the union to pay $3.5 billion in compensation to white farmers who lost their land, although it remains unclear how the government will raise the money. 63-year-old Emiliana Duri, a former Zimbabwean soldier, is one of those that received part of von Petzold's land in 2001. She hopes the government's repossession of land will not affect her. She says it will be painful that the land that we fought for, I am being asked to pave way for a white person when he had left. It's really painful, she says. I will then start to ask, what did I fight for? It's the land only, so I must not be displaced, she says. Even for another black person, because there's no one who is more important than the other. We are all equal, so it's painful, says Duri. Zimbabwe's government says only 3% of those who received land will be affected by the new announcement. The rest of the white farmers would be paid for developments they made on their former properties, but not get back their land. Minister of Agriculture, Anxious Masuka.
It's such a very minute proportion of the beneficiaries. The position of government is that the land reform program is reversible.
The government, meanwhile, wants farmers to concentrate on preparing for the 2020-2021 agricultural season, which began last week with the tobacco planting. Government critics say Zimbabwe's agricultural sector, once the backbone of the economy, went into freefall when Mugabe confiscated land from white commercial farmers and gave it to inexperienced black farmers like Duri. The government attributes the decline to recurring droughts, which it blames on global climate change. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
Civil society groups in Rwanda have called on the government to reconsider some of the guidelines it has put in place to control the spread of the coronavirus. The country has reported about 4,000 cases of the virus, and the government has blamed the spike on complacency. Late last month, the government expanded a national curfew from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. 13 civil society organizations said in a letter to the government that some guidelines lack clarity and are contradictory, leading to inconsistent interpretation. In addition, the group says some of the guidelines are unaffordable. Dr. Joseph Raraza Nkurunziza is the chairman of the Rwanda Civil Society Platform.
Of course, we understand the guidelines and where the government is coming from. $50, the cost for carrying out the tests for COVID-19 virus. So of course, given the conditions that have prevailed after the COVID, somehow, somewhere, it's a bit challenging to be able to afford it. But of course, we also understand that there is need to protect the citizens. There is also need to make sure that the livelihoods of these citizens continues. So it's like a balancing the two. So it's costly. It needs an inclusive approach.
Did you say that the city of Kigali also has imposed certain fines for those who do not abide by the COVID-19 enforcement regulations? And what are those fines?
As I said, some of the members of our platform were also part of this advocacy group that came up with the call of action. When you look at the statement, the city of Kigali also came up with a guideline. As you read in the statement, they indicated various, the city of Kigali, the Rwanda Development Board, so various institutions had suggested various guidelines regarding the COVID prevention. So it's not the city of Kigali alone.
The last I checked, I think Rwanda had registered about 4,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Do you understand why the guidelines might be this stringent?
Yeah, of course. The reason why the government and different government institutions are trying to come up with guidelines is to at least make sure that they minimize interaction and they minimize the infections, because God forbid, if we have more infections, we might end up having a number of patients that might surpass the capacity of the health infrastructure. If the number surpasses the capacity of the health infrastructure, that means infecting the economy. So I understand where these different institutions come from, but there is also to try and make sure that they look at the entire holistic and an integrated and inclusive way of how to protect and minimize the COVID infections, but also make sure that the livelihoods of the citizens is not affected.
Dr. Raraza Nkurunziza is the chairperson of the Rwanda Civil Society Platform. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. And that's it for this Wednesday, September 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show. designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.